Next case is 03-2168, Board of Education for Berea City School District and Manlaw Investment Company versus Cuyahoga County Auditor. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you. May it please this honorable court, my name is Fred Siegel of the firm of Siegel, Siegel, Johnson & Jennings. We have offices in Cleveland, Columbus, and in Pittsburgh. I first like to, we represent the appellant, taxpayer Manlaw. I would first like to thank this honorable court for giving me the opportunity to appear before the full court as opposed before the master. I think this is an important case that should be given full consideration by this honorable court. I also would like to split my argument, generally speaking, 10 minutes and 5 minutes. If I go longer, I know I will have less in my rebuttal.
You do watch your time on the clock there, Mr. Siegel.
Okay. Now, this case is really important because its resolution in favor of the taxpayer will resolve and correct a continuing improper procedure found in real estate tax proceedings in Ohio. As this honorable court knows, this court has stated and agreed with almost all courts in the nation that the income approach, one of the traditional approaches to determine value, should be given the most consideration to determine the assessment value for real estate taxes of income-producing properties. Of course, the subject property is an income-producing property. The other traditional approaches to value are the cost approach and the comparable sales approach, which are given some consideration when appropriate.
Counsel, let me take you back even more basic, because it seems to me that the statute language here about the arm-length sale is the initial basis, and we don't even get to, you know, income approach and sales approach and all those other things unless we have to get past that. And the statute, to me, says the subject of an arm's-length sale between a willing seller and a willing buyer shall consider the sale price of such lot to be the true value. Not shall consider it to be a factor, it's shall consider it to be the true value. And here, they basically said, we don't consider that the true value, even though we agree it's an arm's length transaction. So we're going to look at all these other methods. If we find that this is a willing seller, willing buyer, therefore the statute controls, do we even need to get to these other issues?
I fully agree. Let me say that, first of all, that this was an arm's length sale was admitted by all the parties.
Other property exchange that we often see in getting around the true value?
Absolutely not. And if this court found that to be so, which I believe it should find, then my argument would certainly be shortened substantially.
If we accept their proposition that this is not true value because there's other market conditions, not something in the sale itself, but other market conditions, don't we then in every case have to look at everything else in addition to the sale and go beyond what the statute says?
That would be so. What happened here, which I'm getting into now, is a very serious problem. You know, I talked about the income approach to value.
Mr. Siegel, as you get into that, could you flesh out the facts? I'm sure it's in the record someplace, but it isn't. Doesn't seem to. I didn't find it in what I read in the briefs. This lease was entered into 69 or something like that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the property was sold in an arm's length transaction a few months before the tax lien date.
That is correct.
And what term was left on the lease at the point that new purchasers acquired it?
Well, what happened was the original term was 20 years with an option for 3 5-year,
right,
which is quite normal for these kind of leases at the time they were entered into. And I believe there was, they probably were in the option period, one of the option periods. I don't really remember.
Well, that's what I'm asking you, is exactly how, if you take the 20 years and you stack on the 15, the three option periods, that brings you out with a lease that's going to terminate in a couple years after the property was acquired.
That is quite correct. That would have been the 35 years.
Are there any facts in the record that indicate there had been any renewals or anything that would extend it beyond the point at which the renewal period was due to expire?
There are none to my knowledge.
All right. And the lease also provided a kicker in the rent for gross sales.
Yes.
And were they achieving that or not?
First of all, may I just preface my remarks by saying that was very common at that time.
I understand
to have
that.
A minimum rent with percentage rent.
And when the lease was entered into, Kmart was a strong entity, and at the time of the sale, Kmart wasn't.
That's
We understand all of that.
Though they bought Sears, may I suggest. But
right.
In any event.
But we're talking 96, and Kmart was in trouble in 96.
Right. May it please the court, but.
So were they getting a rent?
Yes, they were. They were getting percentage rents. When they did more sales, they got the percentage rent. The amounts actually.
So Mr. Weiler factored that in doing his income approach.
He did, in fact.
He had that available to him and
absolutely
factored that in arriving at his determination of value.
Absolutely.
All right.
I agree with Your Honor, and this shows the arm's length nature of the lease all through the period and when it was executed. It should be considered what the conditions were at the time of the valuation date.
Okay,
was January.
Let me ask you this about Board of Education's appraiser. Did I read someplace that as his comparable, he used the space that Kmart had vacated, the 20,000 square feet that had been rented a year or so after the tax lien date. He used it as a comparable, something that didn't exist at the time.
Your Honor, it did exist. The full premises was leased to Kmart. Kmart didn't use the full premises and used about 20,000 square feet for storage. And so when the new buyer came in, he negotiated with Kmart, who didn't need this extra space, and it was the new buyer, my client, Manlaw, that got that tenant after acquisition of the property.
What I'm asking you is the appraiser used that new lease for the 20,000 square feet as his comparable, is that correct?
He relied somewhat upon it, but it was, of course, only 20,000 square feet while the premises was 117,000
I understand
square
that.
Feet.
And did he make any adjustment when he did these market rents for the fact that you now have a 30-year-old building that presumably has some functional obsolescence as well?
Not that I can find.
All right.
Now, by the way, that certainly points up what I'm talking about here. In the income approach, there are certain elements that have to be determined. The first element, obviously, is the income derived from the property. The second element is net operating, the operating expenses, one taken away from the other, and you get the NOI, the net operating income. And the third element is, in reality, the capitalization rate, which is applied to the NOI, the net operating income, to achieve value. This is commonly done all the time. Now, what you find here, and which is the disturbing part I'd like to bring to this court's attention, since I've operated and litigated these cases and appeared before various tribunals for over 40 years in handling ad valorem taxation. The point that concerns me is the unfairness of the procedure. Most appraisers will agree on the operating expenses, you know, both sides. And they'll also agree more or less on the capitalization rate. But ha-ha, the third point being the income, they, meaning those that are trying to increase the real estate taxes, will say, well, we have to disregard the actual income that the property brings in as of the valuation date, January 1, 1997, in this particular case. And what you find continuously is the party that wants to increase taxes disregards the rents, and their appraiser and their expert puffs it up to a higher rent in order to, in the end result, increase real estate taxes.
Well, Council, we're aware of that, and isn't part of the problem. When you track through these cases, the Wynwood case, you probably wouldn't say was the case that started all of this. Was
actually,
it really wrong, was it?
The Wynwood case didn't say what it's been
held to say. So the problem has come in some of the language of the pronouncements of this court that have then been globbed onto by the Board of Tax Appeals and on down the line.
Right.
Your argument is we need to further elaborate or modify or overrule. You'd probably like to see us overrule a couple of those cases, but it at any rate, further instruction from us, in your view, would be required or beneficial, that there's a problem with these tax cases when matched up with the economic realities of the marketplace.
I agree. May I suggest to this honorable court that procedure should be as follows, that assuming that there is no evidence that the original execution of the lease in question, in any case, was done under normal market conditions for the use and occupancy of the premises, then that lease should be accepted, even though it may be 20 years later. Because in effect, it does represent what the property should be leased for, because these parties in the open marketplace came to that conclusion.
Then, Council, would your first preference be that we write a rule of law stating that upon the appropriate showing of an arm's length transaction, that the purchase price is the valuation for the purposes of tax? And absent that, your second preference would be a modification of or direction on the appropriate method for valuation? What are you asking us to do
okay.
here?
I've tried to cover all bases, may it please the court. What the honorable judge here said is I'm in full agreement with. In this particular case, there is no reason not to accept the arm's length sale.
Well,
that
since
occurred.
We don't write law for just one case, and we'd like to see an application for all cases similarly situated, your first preference would be for this court to write a rule of law saying, in the face of an arm's length transaction, that the purchase price is the tax value.
That is correct, assuming that all the elements of an arm's length transaction are present at the time of that, you know, purchase.
And what does that do to the certainty and the finality of the whole philosophy or policy for tax collections?
That's a truly Excellent question. Again, it makes it more objective.
Thank you.
This information is used by the county, the division of the tax commissioner, known as the tax equalization section, which goes to every county and picks up these arm's length sales and uses them to determine an equalization rate. And that has been being done for almost as long as I've practiced before these boards and these matters. And that's correct. It would be more objective in almost all the cases, and going any further or looking behind it does not, and in this particular case certainly is not necessary.
Well, that does mean, does it not, that I think in following up on Justice O'Connor's question, it means that the tax valuation will change based upon what a willing seller and willing buyer decide it will be.
That's right. Actually what occurs.
The school board, then those who depend upon the real estate tax for their income, their support, there's not much certainty there, particularly if it's a short-term lease.
No, in actuality, that's what occurs. There is a conveyance fee statement that is filed when a deed is filed on a arm's length transaction. And it's, in fact, the conveyance fee statement says itself it's an arm's length transaction. And these are computerized, and they're found by the school boards. And when they make their budget, that could be taken. That is in fact taken into consideration.
But your
so
point
that,
is
the manner in which they earn their money is not affected because the use of arm's length transactions are reported because they are.
Well,
and
it can be
used.
Affected by the amount of money they receive based upon the valuation. Can
that
sure
is
they
correct.
Know what it is, but. But it could be if Walmart had this lease, I guess the property might be valued higher.
Okay, I have to go back again to my statement that when the original lease was entered into, that it was in all respects arm's length. A Kmart lease or a Walmart lease, we represent them. What happens there is the property is constructed and there's a sale and lease back between the parties.
But your point is that the economic rent of comparable space at the time of valuation ought not be used. The actual amount specified in the lease document is what should be used. Is that your point?
Yes. In most cases, there are exceptions to that. For example, certain Walmart, Kmart, and other such leases of high creditworthy tenants, where there's a contrivance involved, where in the user of the premises, the Kmart, Walmart, builds the place, sells it to investors, and leases it back at a rate contrived to give the investor a rate of return at that time. Has nothing to do, necessarily, with what should be charged for the use and occupancy of the premises. So there are exceptions. But in this particular case, it does not apply. Here, the arm's length sale should be relied upon.
You've used your time, Mr. Siegel.
My time is, I'm sorry?
Your red light's been on for 2 minutes.
Okay. My full 15 minutes have been used?
Your full 15 goes quickly, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. May I have a few? Yeah. Well, may I have another minute?
I'll give you 30 seconds for rebuttal,
okay.
Like I do everyone. But
this real
not
problem.
Now, Mr. Siegel, you won't get the 30 seconds unless you sit down.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Hinkle.
Mr. Hinkle, if we would you agree that the Wynwood Apartments case started all this discussion of market rents versus that's where this all started, isn't it?
Well, no, actually, I would disagree that I think it starts actually with the legislature. If we go to the statutory scheme, if I may.
All right, but in the Wynwood case, which is the Canton Towers and then the Alliance Towers,
yes,
flow from that. So this court's looking at the statute.
Right.
Okay, so yeah, I'll give you, there's a statutory framework out there. But in the Wynwood case, which I think was unanimous, the court starts right out and says, in order to determine the taxable value of the subject property, the Board of Tax Appeals must first determine the true value in money. There was no recent arm's length transfer of the property to serve as best evidence. And that's the premise upon which they move on.
That's
here,
correct.
Undeniably, there is a recent, you know, 6 months or less than a year earlier,
mm-hmm. yeah,
arm's length transaction determining the sale price of the property. You would agree with that?
Well, the sales price was an arm's length sale in that it was between people that were unrelated. But what was sold was not the entire bundle of rights that comprise fee simple ownership of the property. What was in place was a long-term leasehold that was very valuable. And
how long was left on that lease?
I do have that, Your Honor. The lease was executed in 1967. It took effect in 1969. It was a 25-year lease with 3 5-year options. So it was renewed in each of 94, 99, and 2004.
I thought it was a 20-year lease.
That statement was incorrect.
Right.
The record indicates it's 25 years.
With that, three options to renew.
That's correct.
So it terminates when?
2009.
The second thing about the Wynwood case is that that's a whole different, that lease was a whole different kettle of fish, was it not? It was $18,000 a year for 18 years, and then the lease dropped it to $6,000 a year for the several renewal periods out into the future. So that's more like a rent-to-own kind of arrangement, or as Mr. Siegel pointed out here, many transactions occur where the tenant-to-be hires the contractor, has the building built to their specifications, sells it to investors with a lease, and what they're really selling is an investment. And even he acknowledges there you would disregard the lease and look to the market to determine
I think that's what occurred here. This property was built in 1919. Lease was entered to in 1967, where Kmart agreed to lease it for 25 years and had three additional options for 40 years. The property owner built the property and then leased it for this long period of time. And in many ways, you know, almost akin to a sale, I know that's not the transfer, but they gave up their right of ownership and of possession and instead took an income stream. This case, interesting enough, this exact property has been before this court before the BTA and before the Supreme Court highlighted in the reply brief that Mr. Siegel submitted that this case was before this property actually was before this board, and I think some of this history is important in the Howard case cited in the outline.
Was the appellant the owner at that time?
No, it was a different owner, but what occurred is that in 1980 this property was sold for $1,282,000. In 1984, it was sold for $1,959,000. The property went before the BTA for years 1982 and 1983. The property owner's appraiser at that time valued it for 1982 at $1,850,000, close to that sales price, and again in 1983 at $2 million. The Board of Education had an appraiser come in. That appraiser valued it at $2.6 million for 82. $2.8 million for 83. So you can see the divergence between the appraisal values and the sale price. The BTA came back and said the property was worth $2.7 million for both of those 2 years, taking exactly the average of the Board of Education's appraiser. This court reversed and remanded it to the BTA, saying you didn't give enough discussion, or you didn't give any discussion as to why you didn't take into account the sale and what did you do with contract and economic rent.
Counsel,
on reverse and remanded, they came back to 2.7.
Could you educate us as to the actual lease and the actual rents, why it is fair, why it is required under the statute? I think how you get where you would like us to be is using the Canton Tower and then the Alliance Tower cases, but those are our cases, And what I'm having a very difficult time understanding is, here you have an arm's length transaction, but you want to tax the real estate owner based on a fictitious value. You can't buy this building without it being subject to the lease. And so nobody's going to pay more than what the lease and the length that's left to go before you're released from that would indicate would be a fair market value.
What occurs there?
So aren't you asking us for a rule of law that requires taxation to be based on something that is mythological and not available to the owners?
No, Your Honor, I don't think we are, because what we have here is that...
Well, how is the market rent available to the owners?
How it's available is there's two separate transactions here. There's a leasehold interest that Kmart negotiated a lease price. They could be paying the tax on that. Rewriting the law and reversing all this law would be is that we are to now value real estate as encumbered as opposed to unencumbered. If we value it as encumbered...
Well, let me ask you about the word encumbered. The Alliance Towers refers to that property as being encumbered mm-hmm. by those leases. But it also quotes the definition of encumbrance as something that takes away from the value.
In fact, the leases in
Alliance Tower enhanced the value. They were enhancements. They were not encumbrances.
That's correct.
The case doesn't say anything about enhancements.
One of the cases that also deals with this is the Ratner case. And in the Ratner case, dealing with an initial question as whether the sale ought to control, this court considered it. And in the Ratner case, I quote, "We had never adopted an absolutist interpretation of 5713.03, which provides that the sale price of a parcel shall be considered by the auditor to be the true value where the parcel has been the subject of a recent arm's length sale." The court went on to say, and I quote, "The legislature, knowing our historical rulings that the sale price is the best evidence of the true value of property, but only for the evidence of its value, when it amended revised code 5713.03, would have used language more forceful than that the auditor shall consider the sales price to be the true value of the property if it had wished to adopt another principle." So in the prior case of Ratner, this court acknowledged that the legislature, that's why I said initially with the legislature.
But as Justice Stratton pointed out earlier, the statute says we should look to the sale price as the evidence of the value where the transaction is arm's length.
And if it's a sales price of the entire property, but what has sold here is not the entire bundle of rights that comprise the ownership of this Kmart. What has sold is a portion of it, namely the fee simple with the lease in place, the leasehold value, which inures to Kmart, which was admitted by the property owner's appraiser to be a very substantial value.
So you basically want the rule to say a willing buyer versus a willing seller subject to leases. I mean, you're adding a clause in this statement. I mean, people buy and sell property all the time subject to leases, and that's what gives us its fair market value. You've got a long-term lease locked in. It's maybe a good one, maybe it's a bad one. It affects how much you pay for the property. And you want to modify this to say willing seller, willing buyer, but you have to consider the leases.
What I am asking that it be unencumbered, which is what I understand the law has always been.
So why can't we take it the next step and say, okay, willing buyer, willing seller, you bought this piece of property, but you could have torn the building down and built a 50-story building and made more money, so we're going to tax you on the basis of what you could have made on this property. That's what you're saying. Tax them on what they could have made on the property if they hadn't bought it subject to a lease. That's not the real world.
Well, I think that these cases go both ways, that the Wynwood case, the Ratner case, the Canton Tower
case. And the Wynwood case, as we've already agreed, did not have a willing buyer and a willing seller, so it's not applicable in my opinion.
This case is just, I see it as the flip side of the federally subsidized cases, where under the federally subsidized cases of Canton Towers and Alliance, there was an above-market rent created because there was federal subsidy given in the mortgage. And as a result, the property under a market rental was worth more money.
Well, counsel, by the time you got to Alliance Towers, I mean, the court started out with Wynwood. They're unanimous. But you get to Canton Towers, and the author of the Wynwood situation dissents along with Judge Locher in the application in the Canton Towers, and then you get to Alliance Towers, and you've got a plurality opinion. You've got three votes for the opinion, one for the syllabus and judgment, and three dissenters. So that should indicate the court's maybe rethinking the issue. I have another question about this.
Please.
Encumbered. If you read Alliance Towers, there's some language in there that says, you know, it takes, I mean, I understand your argument, we should just value the fee simple. It says that you ignore all other kinds of things, including easements and deed restrictions. Now, how is that fair to any property owner that acquires a title that's encumbered by easements and deed restrictions to just ignore those and say, well, if those easements weren't there and if the deed restrictions weren't there, as Justice Stratton said, you could build a skyscraper here. That's what the language of the case says.
Well, I've got the Alliance case there where it says, for real property tax purposes, the fee simple state is to be valued as if it were unencumbered. And in that instance, to put a place upon the auditor the difficulty of trying to value each and every parcel where a title search would have to be done in order to determine whether there were easements, as well as the auditor doesn't have underlying leases as to any specific property, it would put the auditor and the taxing authorities in a position where each and every property would not be valued based upon what's occurring in the market, but they would have to go behind it and look at and continue to go on.
Let me give you an example.
Such other things.
At the end of the runways at any airport, there may be overflight restrictions and easements that prevent you building anything residential where noise would bother you. Do you just ignore that because there are nice homes mile away?
No, that would clearly be taken into account, and I've seen that taken into account. This school district borders Hopkins Airport. We have properties that are adjacent to that,
okay, but
and included by appraisal.
If you read the literal language of Alliance Towers, it says you ignore all of that and just appraise the fee simple.
I've not been involved with cases that ignore the zoning in the highest and best use analysis. It has to be legally permissible, and so in those instances, if it's not legally permissible, then it affects the value. But I think from an overall perspective, and I see my time is almost over, is that what the court is faced with here is to take long-term leases and asked to take that property off of the tax duplicate. And that's what's been asked of the court today. If we're going to look behind there, the court is going to ask auditors and valuation to slide down a slippery slope, because the next thing, just like, will be mortgages. If you deal with a mortgage, do we then have to look at a property? It's now encumbered by a mortgage, like the lease. If it's a below-market mortgage, it was taken out in 1990, well, when rates were lower. Now it's above that. Do we now have to value that based upon the mortgage that's in place? Or alternatively, if it's a fixed-rate mortgage that has a prepayment penalty, as many do now, do we now have to take that into account for the sale? If you're going to go to a point of saying encumbered by the lease, then we also have to look also at the mortgage. And we get into a point that we are now valuing it totally different than this court has addressed.
If this property was sold with an above market lease, would your school board be in here arguing that that's the wrong valuation, it should be what the market rate is?
Actually, our school board has that. We don't get here. I mean, we will, if they change the law, we'll be back here. But currently, right now, next to the our school district is the airport, where we have numerous cases where the market rent is less than the actual rent, and we've had those cases before our school district for Aerospace Tech Park for the last 12 years.
And your school has contested those?
No, because
you get more money. You don't want to contest those. You only want to contest them as under market, but you don't want to contest them as over market. Because that would be cutting your own income.
No, no. What we've done is we understand that to be the law, so we haven't taken that up on appeal to try and reverse the law.
You've used your time, Mr. Hinkle.
Thank you.
Mr. Siegel, even though your telephone interrupted Mr. Hinkle, you may take 30 seconds for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court, I appreciate my learned colleague using all my cases that I personally filed before this court against me. I assure you that any way you interpret these cases, they do not support his position. Now, going on further, it is apparent from what I've said, and I didn't have a chance to argue the issue, that a leasehold interest is not taxable in Ohio. It is not taxable as held by this court in Lockbourne and other similar cases, Visicon, as cited in our briefs. I'd like to conclude by saying that the determination of the Board of Tax Appeals' opinion was unreasonable and unlawful and should be reversed. In addition to that, I asked this court to direct what the value of this property was in its final conclusion here, and that is $2,600,000, because there's no question that that was an arm's length sale that can be relied upon. In the alternative, if honorable court feels appropriate, they can remand it back to the Board of Tax Appeals with instructions to correct their unreasonable and unlawful conclusion. And I thank the court for additional time.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.